there's so many moving parts to our economy and society that it's hard to say, oh yeah, I can pin down exactly what's happening. I see the causal chain and it's all like, no, actually things are so complicated that we sort of desperate for some simplistic story to try to make sense of things. And then those stories end up setting the agenda or the narrative, and they may or may not actually be accurate.
Welcome to Millennial Majority. Today, I'm joined again by Charles Hugh Smith, the author of The Mythology of Progress. And we're going to be discussing anti-progress in two forms that it comes in that I think is very notorious in our economy. The first one is reverse leverage. And a second one is one of my favorites, which is hot potato economics. Charles, could you lead us into your discussion on how anti-progress has manifested first in reverse leverage and tell us a little bit about what that is?
Okay, that's a great topic, Adam. So what I mean by reverse leverage is, you know, normally when we talk about we're going to leverage something up, right? It means that we're going to take a small sum of money or a new skill or something, and we're going to turn it into something much larger. You know, we're going to get a big return on that investment. So for instance, we're going to spend $9 today and we're going to get $90 return because we leveraged up that capital or that skill or that opportunity. Reverse leverage is we scrimp and only spend $9 today to save a dollar, and it's going to cost us $90 to fix what's going to break in the future. So in other words, instead of generating a return that's tenfold, we're actually generating a future expense that's 10 times the what we saved. And so that's like reverse leverage. And there's a lot of examples of this. And in a previous program, I mentioned that one of my friends had a McMansion that was about 10 or 15 years old, and all the windows had rotted out because they were made with finger joint pine for the window frames, which is notoriously soft and absorbs water and it rots quickly. The builder probably saved about $3,000 on this big house in using the cheap windows with the pine window frames. And then my friend had to spend $30,000 to fix the rotted windows. So save $3,000. Costs you $30,000. That's reverse leverage. And I think you have an example in your recent experience with your electrical system and electrical panel box.
Yeah, it's one of those things, Charles. And this topic came up because we've discussed, if you've seen any of our previous episodes, we've discussed how sometimes it feels like we're robbing the future with some of the things we do, where we know that if we spent 30, 40 more dollars, it would save us hundreds or thousands. And only does it make sense in worlds where you're not the one who's going to bear those consequences, which too often that's been the case, especially the way we've set up our economy. So we had some stuff with a fuse box in the house where we went and looked, and the guy looked at it and shook his head as soon as he took the panel off and went, I was doing building when they did this stuff. It was like $20, $30 more to upgrade to the better one that was bulletproof and would last you decades. This one, I replace them all the time. But to that builder who was looking at short-term quarter-to-quarter profits, and it was just about how much can I extract, why wouldn't they save $30 or $40? That's going to be the homeowner's problem, and it won't be their problem for a while. It'll last 10, 15 years. Why am I going to spend a little bit extra more money? And, you know, it'll last 50, 60 years. That has nothing to do with me. So it feels like this reverse leverage is something that it irritates me a lot. And if I can go into a quick story, and Charles, you and I have talked about it before, but it's one I've wanted to say for a long time, and this is the perfect time. When I first started running my own business, I hired my employees, and I had been working, and I was still working my own job, and I'd worked a lot of minimum wage jobs. So I made sure when I hired my employees, I paid them well, and they had good jobs, and I tried not to micromanage, and I wanted to make sure I gave good health benefits. So I reached out to a company, my accountant helped me, and I was like, oh, okay, this is great. There's tax credits, blah, blah, blah. And I came to the point where they were like, okay, do you want to add, you know, dental and vision? And I'm like, yep, I do. I know a lot of companies don't offer these. You know, can you tell me about how much it is? And the lady on the phone stopped for a second. And I could almost hear her wincing like, sir, it's going to be like the basic, vision is like $3 more an employee. And the dental and vision one was, I think dental was $3, vision was $6 or vice versa. It was very cheap. We were young at the time. But I stopped for a second. Hold on. Lots of companies don't offer these. I thought that was because they were expensive, or let's just say $150 for the medical benefits. I figured it would be 20 to 30% of that. What's another $50, $80 or something? And the lady was like, absolutely not. And I stopped there because she was a broker. I said, ma'am, I know I'm young, but can I ask this? I said, why in the hell do they not offer this if it's so cheap? And they go, because they can. And then she went into some stories that I don't want to go into, but she just told me about how companies, when they've got to cut something, it's very easy to cut and they can. And it was one of those moments, I think it was like a pulling back the curtain on a Wizard of Oz kind of thing, where it really stuck with me the rest of my life that people could make such a small disinvestment, I guess, where they no longer gave you dental or vision to save $9 a month per employee, but it could cost those employees hundreds or thousands of dollars a month and just make their quality of life substantially worse. And the only reason you would do that is if it didn't impact you in any way and you were forced into thinking short term, which would be anti-progress, in my opinion, in some of its purest form. But go ahead, Charles. I've gone on quite a diatribe there.
No. I think that's an excellent example of what we're talking about and why anti-progress is so destructive for like the entire society and economy is the mindset there that you describe. And you described before we started recording it, you called it, I think very appropriately, quarter-to-quarter capitalism. So it's not just maximizing profit, which can be done in a variety of ways. It's like maximizing profit by focusing solely on the short term and on using, and never mind about reverse leverage, and never mind about the effect on the people in your system, right? The customers and your employees. So when you think about this $9 a month in vision and dental, it's reverse leverage on steroids because, as you said, the employee will very likely, at least some employees, will say, well, I'm not going to go to the dentist because I have to pay cash. And if I'd had insurance, I would have gone. So they don't go to the dentist regularly. Then, of course, they start having dental problems, more cavities or you know, tooth decay or gum disease, whatever. And then the cost is now, in as you say, in the mega thousands to fix what could have been treated early, right? And for much less expense. And so this effect on the quality of life, as well as the pain and suffering of having all this dental work done, all of that could have been put aside with the $9 a month. But instead, it was like the mindset is it's if it doesn't fit on a spreadsheet, then it doesn't count, right? And so you don't put the well-being of your customers and employees on a spreadsheet. That doesn't count, right? What counts is the money. So this whole mentality that we called in previous programs, the kind of bean counter mentality, where we're going to quantify everything, except we're going to leave out everything that really matters, because that can't be quantified, right? Like nobody's quantifying reverse leverage. That's the problem. And that's anti-progress in its purest form. You know, what really matters, it's not on the spreadsheet because it's hard to quantify. What's easy to quantify is money. And then that's what I'm incentivized to do because that's what I was hired to do, right? And we were speaking before we started recording about this. There's sort of an echo chamber here, this whole bean counter mentality that dominates corporate America, which is you go to school, you get an MBA at a top school, and you're trained to be a bean counter and to focus on the spreadsheet. And that's what you're hired by corporate America to do, is to save them money, do some reverse leverage, focus on next quarter. And so you have no knowledge of what actually matters, which is the quality of life of your employees and the quality of the goods and services you're providing to the customer, right? That's none of your purview at all. You're there to squeeze a little more profit out of whatever can be put on the spreadsheet. And then who do you hire as you advance up the ranks? Well, you hire other MBAs from your same alma mater, right? There's this, as you said, it's like an echo chamber mentality where no one's coming in and saying, hey, you guys are doing the most incredibly destructive anti-progress thing possible here. Why don't you wake the heck up? There's nobody to say that. And so this is how anti-progress just keeps grinding on, advancing and expanding, because it's a mindset that feeds on itself, because no one can question you if you say, well, hey, never mind all that reverse leverage stuff. What matters is we made more profit this quarter. We won. And I'm being lauded by the executive, you know, the executive floor, because I squeezed a little more profit out. So there you go. Who gets incentivized to pursue that? What incentive is there to try to quantify all the meaningful stuff that's difficult to quantify? There's no incentive whatsoever.
The late, great Charlie Munger said, which is, you show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. And if you set a system that is profit over everything, right? And this is coming from two business people in here. There's a very big difference between strip mining your economy and business or the planet, literally to the point where there's nothing left, versus making profit and investing and doing a portion and running a business the way most sane people would run anything you wanted to last long term, right? Nobody else would do this. You would never have a broken leg and you would just put Band-Aids on it and be like, well, if I just tape it together or whatever, I can save more money this quarter or this month in my budget, right? You would think that's crazy. I'm going to be stuck with this leg the rest of my life. But if the economy has turned into, which kind of segues in our next topic, which is one of the things that I really like, which is hot potato economics, where if you have an entire economy where everybody is, let's use the windows because it's a little bit of a cleaner example. If everybody is, okay, I can save $3,000 on this house build and I use this pine, this cheaper window stuff that, yeah, is it going to fall apart and whatever, but I want to get this bid and I can underbid the other guys because they're going to use good stuff. So I get the bid and they're just doing a lowest bid contract. So bam, I got it. If the homeowner has to pay $30,000 in 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 years, heck, they'll probably have sold the home anyway. So it won't be their problem or my problem, right? My job is just to build it. Well, that's fine. But if you do that everywhere, across the entire economy, you end up in positions. And for the audience that's listen, I'm sure we all know somebody who buys cars or appliances and then gets rid of them every couple of years. If you go, yeah, some of those people are just people that are like, hey, I only want new stuff. I want the latest, greatest, sure. But you ask a lot of those people, and I know some of them, they say it's because once you get over 60,000, 80,000, 100,000 miles, as soon as the warranty runs out, it all starts to fall apart. So I sell it before it can go wrong. I think we have to be very careful because much like in hyperinflation in economies where people start buying things as quick as they can and they try to get rid of their money because it's losing value, I'm worried we may do the same thing with appliances or homes or pretty much everything that we buy, because everybody knows nothing lasts anymore. So we're all going to be trying to get rid of everything as fast as we can. And that doesn't lead to a good place if it's just the last person standing is essentially stuck with the hot potato burn in their hand because they're too poor to sell their home. So they've got a roof falling apart, the windows that are, you know what I mean, Charles? This feels like anti-progress will first take all of these things from us, the quality of life and everything that we've talked about in previous things. And then we're just going to be left with this hollow shell of what was an economy. And it's all going to be falling apart at once. And everybody is going to be looking around going, I don't understand. How are the bridges falling apart? The homes are falling apart. The cars don't work and the appliances suck. And they'll be looking around going, it can't all be wrong at once. But it was 40, 50 years of us saving a little money here, making it a little cheaper, putting patches on it. And it'll just lead us to such a terrible place.
Absolutely. And I can easily kind of envision a dystopia, kind of like that animated film WALL-E, where the robot's going around a planet just filled with broken junk and it's supposed to clean it all up, right? And that the problem is that's actually real, because to take like an example of an appliance, well, it can't be fixed, right? Because it's got a digital board, you know, it's got an electronic board now that's a one piece unit. And I actually swapped this out for my Kenmore dryer that came with a house. And it's not easy. And the board is a few chips and a bunch of several circuit boards. It's probably cost about, I would honestly say, knowing that commodity chips are like $1, $1.50, the whole thing probably costs about 10 or 15 bucks, and including the plastic mold. Well, it's $180. right? Plus shipping. Well, you can buy a new dryer for like $400. So you're talking about the electronic thing that you have to replace, because there's no way to know anything other than you got to replace the whole motherboard. It's like half the cost of a dryer. And now I did the work myself. If I'd had hired somebody, it would have cost like $150 just to show up, right? So then you go, well, why should I repair this, right? Because, or it's unrepairable because you have to go buy a new one, or it's the same price. Or you decide, well, the new one is a little bit more, but this one's already broken down once. What are the odds it's going to break down again? Well, they're very high, right? So everybody that buys anything is now playing hot potato, essentially, because you're either going to have to, if you don't get rid of it or sell it, then you're going to have to replace it or fix it. And those are both going to be really expensive. So, and the thing with a car, I want to mention, I think that you're so prescient in talking about that, is cars are really expensive now. You know, trucks, $50,000-$60,000. Okay, so who's going to end up with that 20-year-old vehicle? Well, it's somebody that only has, like, say, $4,000 to buy a used car, right? So they buy this car, and then something breaks on it, and the repair bill is $4,000, right? That's very common now. That guy barely scraped up enough money to buy the car. Now, there's no way he can scrape up another $4,000 to have it fixed. So it's now junked. And so, and you go, well, wait a minute, why did this happen? And that's what we're talking about, is all the incremental savings using the cheapest component, the cheapest circuit board, the plastic part that used to be cast aluminum. All of those things add up to a massive amount of reverse leverage, literally on the order of 100-fold, right? Because I've seen many examples of this where in appliances where there's a little plastic like ring or a little plastic gearing that, of course, there's no way a plastic gear is going to last more than a few years. So it fails. And then the cost with the labor is so expensive that the refrigerator is junked, right? So whoever ended up with that got the hot potato. And now they have to buy a whole new fridge because of like a part that probably costs literally a dollar or two less. Yeah. So $600 or $800 in expense to save, adding up a few of these little plastic parts and gizmos, what, $10?
It's really sad. And it's kind of, for those of people who aren't familiar with Charles's work, he wrote a book on essentially like on the landfill economy. And this is those chickens coming home to roost, right? This is the, what I would think would be kind of the end result of that, where you've taken planned obsolescence and made it to almost a science, right? Where they're just like, okay, we're going to take this thing that works well, and if we put a plastic gear in here, we'll save 38 cents on this, but it'll fail almost guaranteed within 3 years. The warranty will be 2 years. Bingo, bango. Now we have a new customer every 3 years instead of every 10 years. Because if you don't care at all, if you are just quarter to quarter capitalism, which is just, okay, pure, I just want to make as much money as possible. Why would you spend more money to give more satisfaction to your customer if it has no negative, it only brings you problems because their product lasted 10 years and not 3 years or 2 years. And so the warranty ran out at 2, it failed at 3. If it had lasted to 10, you wouldn't get them to buy 2 or 3 more times. And people might say, oh, well, if they do that, they'll just go with another brand. Okay, we could do a whole other discussion on monopolization and how we've been reduced where there's only a few companies. But even worse than that, they just know that the other companies are all making the same crap. So yeah, you may switch from Whirlpool to LG, but they know that the LG customers, when their stuff fails, they're going to switch to Whirlpool because they're going to be mad. And so you just go, you ping pong between all these companies doing the same thing. So there's nowhere to go, right? So this is like the landfill economics and anti-progress just morph almost finally together in this unholy combination in this hot potato economics, where I literally, not more than an hour ago, had somebody here who just looked at our washer and was like, yep, this part that is almost guaranteed set to fail. I didn't say that, but the guy said, this didn't come from me, but it failed. It's meant to fail. It's after the warranty. And it was left here with the house. And the person said, you could pay us $500 to fix it, or you could get the parts for $250. And, or you could just get a brand new washer of the same similar caliber for $450 right on sale. And he said, just so you know, the boards on here are close to end of life, which end of life is like 4 or 5 years anymore because the warranty, like I said, ran out at 2. So you end up in this horrible thing where you're on a treadmill. And I think it leads into some of the things that you've talked about where retirees and other people, even if they're homeowners, it's not going to be like being a homeowner 50, 60 years ago where your appliances and everything lasted so long that you made an investment and then they lasted. Now you're going to have everything breaking all the time. And that is very hard to have inflation continuing and an income that is not adjusting, right? You have a stagnant income, you've retired, you're on a fixed income, which is the word I was just looking for. And for the rest of your life, you're sitting there going, oh my God, if my roof goes again, it was $12,000. The roofing guy said these things only last 7 years. I don't have another $12,000 to replace it. And that's not saying anything else in your life happens. That's just your constant cheaply made home falling apart on you all the time. And we've discussed this. The people who will suffer the most are the people with the least, the people that can't go anywhere. If you have enough money, you can either bear these problems, just pay for them out of pocket, or you just keep moving. And you can always get the latest and greatest stuff. So you always get the good parts of it. But like you said, it's the poor guy who's Johnny Sixpack, who's working his butt off. And he's going, my savings got wiped out by when the washer, the dryer, and the roof started leaking. And this year it's the windows. And what's next year, right? It gets in this thing where I think it comes where you see a lot of people say the whole you'll own nothing and be happy kind of thing. I understand where that comes from. And yes, I'm familiar with the quote of the guy who said it at the whatever world, the bankers go to pretend like they run the world, which they might. But it definitely seems if it was done nefariously, it would almost be less sad because my biggest worry is it's just greed and ineptitude where we've created our own hell, essentially.
Yeah. And then you mentioned what happens if you're on fixed income, you're an old person with a house that's falling apart. But consider the millennials who are buying like at outrageous prices, right? Houses are really expensive and a lot of people are stretching to the max in order just to pay the mortgage and property tax and insurance. They don't have $20,000 to fix the roof either. And then what are they going to do? They're going to have to go into debt to pay the repairs on the house that should have been solid for another 20 or 30 years. And then what are they sacrificing? Well, there goes the family vacation. There goes the college fund. In other words, these kinds of repairs for vehicles and houses are now so expensive that they're stripping out everything else that you might have wanted to save for, right? Like, in other words, you have to fix the roof or the plumbing or the electrical panel. And that just soaked up the money that you were going to save for your kids' education. That's another element of anti-progress that this hyperinflation you discuss is so pervasive because it comes in various forms. It's not just monetary inflation, like it now everything costs so much more than it did just even a decade ago. It's also like a deflation in the quality that acts in the same way as hyperinflation of money, right? That we're constantly having to devote more of our earnings to make up for what has either risen in cost from inflation or risen in cost from the deflation of quality.
It's so sad that we've never paid so much for so little, which is just it's a sad state of affairs, and it almost makes you just wonder how we even got here. But like we discussed, it's probably not something nefarious. It's probably just we let greed take the wheel, right? If you only incentivize people to make the maximum amount, consequences be damned, guess what? There will be lots of consequences because they didn't care. It's not rocket science. You end up in this position where just no one is happy about it. And you have a very small sector of people who won really big. And that never ends well. Anybody who opened a bloodstained history book and go see how that looks out when there's a very small set of people that win. And that's not a good thing. And that part of this channel and the reason I'm glad to work with you and others is I want to avoid that happening because that is where this is going. And whether it comes in, just some type of revolution or it's not a coincidence that we have never had more polarization and extreme. People are getting fed up and people are starting to lash out because they may not know exactly why everything is screwed up, but they do know everything is screwed up. Just because they don't have the terminology like anti-progress or reverse leverage or hot potato economics or any of the 10,000 other things that we may be able to talk about. You go talk to any average person, and you and I have both worked blue-collar jobs. We've both run businesses. We talk to normal people who don't spend all their time online or try to read 50, 60 books a year or listen to podcasts constantly. And you go talk to them, they know it's messed up. And I can go talk with people who are Gen Z, and I work with a guy who's as a business owner, and I tell him, I'm like, you're going to have it so much worse than I did. And I know that I had it somewhat worse than my mom and them did in some ways. I'm not saying everything is worse. I'm saying from what you can buy, dollars to cents, inflation adjusted, it's worse. And just like the kids coming up today, the Gen Z kids, they got it worse than me. And the kids coming after them have it even worse. And if we don't stop this, we can pass these hot potatoes back and forth. My worry is it's going to be the people that are the youngest and the poorest that are going to be the ones end up holding that hot potato. It's going to burn their hand and they're going to have no one else to hand it off to. And it's not going to end well. And I think every person should read your books on the landfill economy, self-resilience, anti-progress. It will tell you how we got here. And that is one thing that I don't credit enough when you and I talk is that it is very clear, and there's lots of others, The Fourth Turning. I don't need to list off 1,000 books, but just yours specifically because you're here. It goes over in great detail why things are happening and some of the directions it's heading. And you wrote some of these books more than decades ago. So people can go look at your stuff and go, oh, crap, he was right, which is never good. Because anyone who's been alive long enough, when you go look at somebody who's a track record of being right and they say something that you don't want them to be right about, that's when you should be worried.
Yeah. And, you know, thank you, Adam. And I think, again, when we talk about the anti-progress, we are referring to a lot of products, right, in terms of the decline of quality, the higher cost, impossibility of repair. But I think we should also mention in the same way, the quality of life is declining. And I'll use in the same line that we're following here, consider how few people in millennials or Gen Z can look forward to working for a company for their most or all of their career. And this used to be quite common, right? That the employers invested in their employees because they wanted the well-trained and experienced people to stay and serve their corporate needs, right? In other words, that's what you do is you'd invest in your people. And so now it's quite uncommon to find anybody that works anywhere like 10 years, never mind 20 years. And one of my buddies in the Bay Area, one of his friends had worked for Apple for 20 years. And I was like dumbfounded. What? Yeah, that however many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees or subcontractors Apple has, I mean, I was thinking there must be only a handful that have been there for 20 years because that's just not real in corporate America anymore, right? Everybody works somewhere 2-3 years, then they get laid off or they have to move to advance their career or they get a better offer from somebody else. So what kind of mentality does this bring for the employees? Well, a short term, right? What's the point of worrying about making a product that's going to last 20 years when you're only there for 18 months or maybe 3 years, 5 years at the outset, right? At the longest. That's like as long a horizon as we have now in America is like a couple of years. And so the idea that we're no longer investing in people or quality of life, then this just feeds this short-term mentality because everybody's only on board for a while, as long as it serves their career, right? And corporate America has incentivized this kind of revolving door mentality. And so that's also a negative. That's also anti-progress, both for the employees and for the employers.
Yeah, it does feel like short-termism and the things we've talked about essentially have made their way we've reached where we've essentially, the entire economy started to say, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay somewhere for 30 years. This is falling apart. And then millennials, we came in and I remember us getting a whole lot of crap because, oh, they're not loyal to companies and 2008-10 happened for a lot of us. And so that upended things. And then Gen Z kids, they came after and they were like, nope, this is a rigged game. They don't care about us. We're not going to care about them. And I've seen them get flogged even more. And I'm the first one to jump up and down and go, hey, whoa. Just because they're smart enough to see the game and see what we're doing here, don't get mad at them because they know you're going to lay them off and fire them. Because they, you know, I turned 18 in 2008. So I remember taking my brother for his first job application at Chick-fil-A and driving him there. And I remember him standing next to a guy who was literally in a suit, a briefcase, and was applying for a cashier job or a manager job, but would take either because I listened to him. And I remember my brother standing next to me going, I'm never going to get this job. And I had to explain to him, hey, they kind of want, you know, this is, I had to explain in the car home why you don't really want to hire somebody who used to make $140,000 a year at a finance bank to be a cashier. So it was one of those things where we've just lost a lot. And I don't know how we get back from being this short term, you know, and it's gotten to the point where even I catch myself doing, we'll just patch this or we'll just do that because, well, we could just sell the house or whatever. And it's hard not to get sucked into this. Or my girl works for a place and to all respect with bean counters, my partner's an accountant, you know, so it's not just accountants. These are bean counters. It doesn't matter whether they're consultants, people that are just going as short term as they can. And when you look at them and they have to operate in the system, it's very hard not to just become part of it. Well, you need to leave after 2 years because they're not going to give you any promotions because they don't want to do that. And even people, mentors of hers within her own corporate hierarchy was like, well, what you really need to do is leave after 2 or 3 years. Then you come back 3 years later and then they'll pay you a bunch more money. But if you stay, they're never going to value you. And I remember her and I having this conversation is her going, I don't want to jump around to all these companies. Can I just work somewhere? And I'm like, no, we were born about 40 years too late for that. And I know I've gone on a diatribe here a little bit about this, but it is one of those things where I want people to understand that I don't blame so much the people in the system because the system will eventually force you to play the game. It's the don't hate the player, hate the game kind of thing. You have to move this way. Otherwise, the system will just crush you. I'm not for moving companies all the time. So I'm going to stay here for 40 years and get underpaid by 60%. That you're doing no one any favors. This is like a bottom up. We have to change the entire mythology or, you know, to bring your book back into it. But we have to decide as a society, we want to value these things again because between everything, look at any part of our economy. Is anything slowing down? Because in my thing, it feels like we're getting faster and faster and investing less and less.
That's an excellent point, Adam. And I think when we talk about the mythology of progress, what we mean is we're always sold that everything is improving, right? That's what progress is. So the fact that everything is like declining behind this facade of progress, it's hard to recognize because we're constantly inundated with messages that, oh, the new is better, right? Because that, of course, is part of the mythology of progress, is the new is always better simply by being new. But actually, that's not true as we're discussing. So the anti-progress is always hidden behind a sort of a screen or a billboard announcing that progress is always good and you can't stop progress, even when progress is actually anti-progress. So when we talk about the value change that you just mentioned, I think that it's a mysterious process because it occurs within each of us. You know, it's not something that you can easily track or quantify. And we see this happen in recent history, like a lot of the Arab Spring revolutions were triggered by some trivial incident that would have been unnoticed in the past. One protester gets beaten up by the police or something. And it triggers this enormous movement because people's values have changed inside their own minds, right? And so I think that process, I describe it as like what is acceptable or what becomes unacceptable. And so if you take a look at history, like say of the United States, then you can say, well, it was once acceptable to have this racial bias institutionalized in so-called separate but equal schools and drinking fountains and all this other stuff. And then over time, that became unacceptable, right? And so, and a lot of other things are similar, right? Like women are still not paid necessarily the same amount as a male for doing the exact same work, right? And so that over time, that's become less and less acceptable. So what we're talking about is what we now accept, which is a society and an economy riddled with anti-progress that's like, you know, diminishing our quality of life, that has to become unacceptable. Like, well, no, we're just not going to, we're not going to live with that anymore. And what we've given up, which has been acceptable, we want to make something else acceptable. Like now what's acceptable is durability. So everything has to last at least 20 years or we're not going to buy it. So these value changes are going to take time. And what's interesting is how it's all incremental. And anti-progress is like the boiled frog example, right? It's like all of these incremental diminishments of our quality of life and our well-being. If we were body slammed with everything that's happened that's diminished our quality of life over 20 years in like a week, then we'd go, the revolution would start right then, right? Like if all the changes that have diminished our lives over 20 years all happened in like a weekend, then we go, wait a minute, the cost of rent and the cost of housing just tripled overnight? No, I'm let's take to the streets, right? I mean, so the quality of our food is now rubbish, you know, it's like poisoning us. I mean, that's the danger of anti-progress, is it's always incremental and it's always sold as being better because it's new. That's all that matters. If it's new, it's better. But that's not, of course, the case. I just read an article about millennials leaving New Zealand, which, you know, has been held up for decades as like a wonderful place to move and you got a great quality of life, et cetera. Well, like this, the woman that was interviewed is 33 years old. And she said, when we bought this house a few years ago, I planned on being here for the rest of my life. And now we're moving, we're selling, we're moving to Australia because we're burned out. We're not making enough money. The cost of living is rising and everything is harder now. And so you burn out trying to say, I'm gonna stay here for the rest of my life, you know? And that's a very sad statement, but I think it's real for a lot of people. And so the hot potato is not just a product or a house, it's like a whole way of living.
Yeah, and it's gonna land, unfortunately, I feel it's going to land on the people who can least deal with it, as we've talked about. But we've talked about something in the past where I worry you're going to have the largest group of elderly people, which is going to be boomers and what's left of the silent generation. At the same time, millennial and Gen Z are now the largest demographics of adults in the country, in the United States, and soon at one point will be the world. I worry that they're all going to end up essentially dealing with the cost of living in different ways. And unless they actually see they're dealing with it in both different ways, the boomers in Silent Gen who couldn't afford their lifestyle or the wealth has been aggregated. You know, everybody likes, oh, boomers, the worst generation, boomers, all this other stuff. And look, I the memes are funny. I get it. Even some of the millennial memes are funny. But when it comes right down, if you go look, they will have the largest population of elderly people in poverty in the history of the country, as far as I know. And don't quote me, I haven't picked up the statistics, but just something I've seen thrown around as they move more and more to retirement. Now people say, oh, well, their house is worth millions. Yeah. We just talked about that. If they're spending $13,000 to fix their roof and their windows are falling apart and all these things are built like crap, yeah, they may have an $800,000 house, but if they're in the poorhouse because of it, or they literally have to sell it so they can retire and the people coming behind them can't afford it, or it's continuing to fall apart, or even worse, they end up stuck there, which I know people who have ended up in the situation where their house is falling apart. They have the house on the market. They know what they need for their retirement and they can't get it to sell. So then you end up in this horrible situation, specifically for anybody who's in the Florida area. Everybody knows some of the hurricane areas, you see this, and it's absolutely a travesty. And I worry that's the beginning for them. And that's on the higher end of age. And on the lower end, you're going to see what you just talked about, which is Gen Z, millennials, and then some of the alphas and other people coming after, where they won't be able to get on the ladder because it's so high. And I don't know how you end up with both sides outside of just having a very narrow band of who has all the wealth. But to me, if we ever look around and go, hey, if instead of fighting with you and most of you got screwed and most of us got screwed, why are we arguing and doing memes about each other and saying, oh, boomer this, oh, millennial that, oh, lazy Gen Z, or, you know, all the tropes. At some point, I think all the generations need to kind of get around a table and go, who won here? Because none of us are really doing super well as a majority, right? And I think there's a discussion where your books and things on mythology, I think it could be born from that. And I've always, in my utopian optimistic view, I would love to see the great round table of the generations or whatever coming together and being like, yeah, we may disagree on things, but we all got screwed by the same force of inflation or and the different forms that came in and this hot potato economics or anti-progress. Let's go take a look and see how we fix this. And also, who screwed us? Because anyone who thinks that's some utopian thing, I encourage you, go look at societies that fall apart. You will often see extreme right and left wing organizations that completely differentiate on political, religious, or just fundamental differences. When things really fall apart and get bad, they often unite to take down the powers that they both agree, hey, I don't agree with you. I may not even like you, but I know that they got us and let's go get them. And that's what worries me if we don't stop this. I think we're going to see this get very out of hand very quickly. And those often are not bloodless. Not to be too extreme, I know that's somewhat alarmist, but I do believe anti-progress, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Charles, so tell me what you think, but I feel like this could head in a really bad direction if everybody keeps getting poorer, because any person who looks at history sees that doesn't head in a good direction.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, we respond with instinct. We may not understand the mechanics, and of course, that's part of what makes life so complicated now is there's so many moving parts to our economy and society that it's hard to say, oh yeah, I can pin down exactly what's happening. I see the causal chain and it's all like, no, actually things are so complicated that we're sort of desperate for some simplistic story to try to make sense of things. And then those stories end up setting the agenda or the narrative, and they may or may not actually be accurate. So I think if we were going to sit down, I like your idea of the round table. If we were going to sit down, what would be the topic of discussion? I think one of them would be, well, why don't we talk about what progress should mean? What is actual progress? And then let's like make a list, okay? And then we compare that to the way we live now in reality. Strip out the PR and the marketing and everything. And so compare what we know progress should be and what we have. And I think we'd then be able to say, well, clearly what we need to do is set aside what we have now and stop calling it progress. And then we have to start thinking, how do we get from where we are now, anti-progress, into real progress? Just that exercise would help us understand where we are, because there's so much pressure on us to accept the status quo and the current way we live as the best that's ever existed, that kind of stuff. Oh, we're so wealthy and we have so much prosperity. And then meanwhile, we're all stressed out and eating ultra processed snacks, addicted to social media and everything. And it's all like, well, why are we living like we're under such stress and pressure if this is like we're the ultimate wonderfulness? That we're so prosperous and all this. It's all like, well, then how come we're so stressed out and unhappy?
Yeah, it's like in that experiment where they take the dog and they keep shocking it until it essentially gives up. But it'd be almost like if they had a loudspeaker saying, you're doing great. You're a good boy. Your life is amazing. This is the best it gets. You're so lucky. And the dog is just laying there getting shocked, having given up, just being like, whatever. Apparently this is as good as it gets, right? It's some dystopian thing of like, everything is great, citizen. Your life is amazing, you know, and it does make you wonder how we got here. But I encourage people to take a look at Charles's work. I hope our discussion today has kind of explained, you know, the two things we want to talk about most, which is the reverse leverage and the hot potato economics, which kind of comes from that and is a combination of your books. And if I remember right, the book Self-Reliance, you had a book on the landfill economy, and then The Mythology of Progress, which tell people a little bit about those and where they can find all of your works.
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. There's samples of all these books, sample chapters for free, and all my archives are free. And then you can see what I've been writing for the last couple of years on Charles Hugh Smith, substack.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here, Charles. And thank you all for listening, and have a great day, everybody.
Thank you, Adam.